From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the June 2016 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, No Sleep on VE Day. Cynthia Humble was an intercept operator in the ATS from 1944 and was stationed at Forest Moor in the Yorkshire countryside. There she listened intently to enciphered Morse signals, which were whisked off to a place she and her colleagues knew only as Station X. We hear her memories of the intense work, the somewhat rationed but sparkling social life, and how she and her watch did not sleep a wink on VE Day, despite it falling between two gruelling night shifts. But first, the groundbreaking exhibition about codebreaking during World War I, The Road to Bletchley Park, has been extended to tell stories of the impact this pioneering work had on the war at sea, on land and in the air. It also touches on the tribulations of effectively sharing intelligence without revealing its source. Phase one of The Road to Bletchley Park explores some of the people involved in World War I codebreaking who went on to be crucial to the successes of the Government Code and Cipher School during World War II. Now the second phase, which extends the exhibition in the Visitor Centre at Bletchley Park, explores stories including the largest naval battle of World War I and the secret telegram which brought the US into the conflict. Podcast producer Mark Cotton took a sneaky first peek alongside the friends of Bletchley Park at their exclusive preview evening.
Hello. Welcome to MO5E. The room is not very big and there are still two or three more to fit in. Where were you before being recruited to this department?
I was up at Cambridge doing European languages. Enjoying rowing, rugby, beer and playing mahjong.
Here. Let's hope you enjoy deciphering intercepted German wireless messages just as much. But first things first, we must get you a cup of tea.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this Friends preview evening of the second phase of our World War I exhibition, The Road to Bletchley Park. For those who don't know me, I'm Ian Standen, I'm Chief Executive here at Bletchley Park. It's a pleasure to welcome you here for this preview, which the public will then see from tomorrow. A couple of thank yous really for a start. First of all, I must thank our sponsors, BAE Systems and Ultra Electronics, without whose financial support this wouldn't have happened. Thank you to Sarah Ralph. Sarah, make yourself known. Sarah has been the researcher and project lead for this. The vast majority of the work done to drive this forward has been on Sarah's shoulders. She's worked like a Trojan for the last year to get this going, and thank you very much for your hard work for what is, I think you'll appreciate, a very good exhibition. It's also nice to have members of De Grey and the Knox family here with us. Great to have grandchildren of these codebreakers here actually to see the exhibition and be around, and I'm sure they're happy to share their thoughts and views and experiences with you if you want to have a chat with them afterwards. This exhibition is really important for us at Bletchley Park. One, because we are in the centenary of the First World War, and the work that went on at Bletchley Park wouldn't have started in the manner it did without the experience of the First World War. The First World War was really where radio started to be used for military communications. Of course, cable communications had been going since the mid-1800s, and actually radio really came to the fore of the First World War. And the business of code-breaking, intercepting radio communications, and really started in the First World War. And many people in this small but perfectly formed team that came out of the First World War started to learn their trade during that period and were vital in terms of setting up Bletchley Park start of the Second World War. So this is really an important backstory of Bletchley Park World War II, and therefore very important that at the moment we tell that story and an appropriate time to do it in the century of the First World War. So those who've been here before, I expect as friends many of you have, what you saw in the first half of this exhibition was MI1B room 40 and how, if you like, the London end of things happened. What you're going to see now is a bit more about what went on away from London. Intercept stations, how this business helped combat the Zeppelins and Gotha raids. A bit more about how the intelligence produced by Room 40 helped the naval battles. And a little bit more at the end about the Zimmerman Telegram, which we touched on in the first part of the exhibition, but a little bit more depth here about the Zimmerman Telegram, which of course the centenary of which will be next year, and its vital contribution in helping the Americans come into the First World War. Without further ado, I'd like to encourage you to go through and have a look.
They looked like two bright stars. Startled observers in 1915 who watched the lights approaching the Norfolk coast must have wondered if aliens were invading. Locals were right to be fearful. This was the start of something as alarming as a visit from outer space. The Zeppelin's lights heralded the first aerial bombardment of civilians at home in Britain. The bombs and burning incendiaries dropped in January 1915 on King's Lynn and Great Yarmouth claimed four lives and left 15 injured, including two children. There were 20 raids that year. London was hit for the first time in May.
Now you will see, just below it, there's a button. So if you hold the button in,
right.
Brilliant. That's very
good. Yes, now that is wonderful.
That's fantastic. So your wish has become true, gentlemen.
Yes, absolutely.
Brilliant. That is wonderful. And what is absolutely fascinating, too, is actually to see the code-breaking process. In other words, the technical code-breaking process. In fact, they had already got into the code. He and Dilly Knox had got quite a long way into the code, but they still had a long way to go to get through this, to get this far.
And probably the most important telegram in World War One.
Probably the single most important piece of decoding ever, possibly of one single document.
Yes.
I think it's arguable that it is. There have been greater code-breaking events per se, like obviously Enigma and so on in the Second World War.
As a collection of
things, but of a single document, this is possibly the single most important. I remember Simon Singh saying that.
Yes.
And I hadn't thought of it that way until he said so in his television programme, very kindly.
Nigel decoded it with help from Dilly Knox and the Reverend Montgomery. Montgomery was part of the team.
He was a German linguist, mainly.
Oh, was he?
Yes.
That's why where he...
Yeah, he was mainly a linguist, I think. I mean, Nigel had German.
Yes.
But I think that Montgomery was more of a linguist than a code breaker, but of course... It all goes together. You couldn't do the one without the other.
You couldn't. That's absolutely right.
Because like all these things, you have to make guesses.
Yeah. But I mean, to have that, so now people know what it was.
Yes. Very
was it the biggest thing in the war? Yes, it probably was.
Most important single piece of code.
And it was Khan who said that. I think we talked about before, when the author, Mummy and I, had to identify Nigel's writing. Memory said to me that it was written out in German, but it can't have been.
Yes, it is. I've seen it with the handwriting in German. If I recall right, there are the figure groups.
Yes.
And then handwritten in German.
So did they decode it in German?
Yes. Straight into that's first into I've, German.
That must have been what I saw. Then.
Yes.
I mean, I was quite surprised because I'm sure I remembered that being German.
Mm.
So actually what there was probably numbers which I didn't see, or they'd taken the numbers away and done another copy in German only.
Both of you are so proud of your ancestors.
Yeah, well, maybe because, overproud.
Well, no, not at all, not at all. I think proud.
Actually, you know, the original thing that they had up last time had it written in Nigel's hand.
Yes, it did.
Deciphered Nigel the Grey, that Dilly was there and Montgomery was there. There is no doubt, but it says deciphered Nigel the Grey.
Both of them have done a lot of work on that code before this particular telegram came through and landed on Nigel's desk.
Yeah.
So Dilly Knox had done an awful lot towards it and no doubt helped Nigel out with it, but it actually landed on his desk, didn't it? There are no known relations of Montgomery.
Right. Well, he was a priest, wasn't he?
He was a priest, an ascetic, very much. So he almost came from nowhere and went to nowhere.
Yes.
And
well, presumably just faded
away. I
don't
think he had any siblings that anybody knew of.
I don't know.
And therefore no nephews or great-nephews or great-nieces. And nobody has ever come forward. And so he's getting slightly erased.
So he was certainly part of that.
It has always been said that he was, and nobody's ever denied
no,
that he
they
was.
Haven't.
So
no.
I think that one would say that...
You see, I think this is another one of the lovely things about you two, that you could easily stand here and just say, Nigel did all this.
No,
you
don't. Awesome.
You're so open to saying, yes, Dilly helped with this.
It was a team, but he got the credit. I mean, written in his own hand, deciphered by Nigel de Grey. So, yeah, I mean, you couldn't do any of those things on your own, could you? I mean, if you see...
Well, you had to go to sleep occasionally.
Well, exactly. And other people would think about it, and they would say, have you thought about, and all those sorts of things. No, I mean...
Dilly would have been in his bath.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, probably.
Shouting at people.
Yes.
Very unusual message. Doesn't seem to follow the standard patterns of naval terminology. Codes can be so damn tricky to break without a crypt. A practice code, sent by the operator, perhaps. A poem?
Yeah, I mean, you can talk about the subject for always, but I mean, it really is brilliant.
And to be fair, it's such a long time ago, and everybody was very restricted about what they could say or write. So vast areas of it are only hearsay and will only ever be hearsay, I dare say, because you know, I suspect that the original paperwork is now long lost and gone, sadly.
The way this is displayed
now. Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah, no, I think that's wonderful.
Really, really, really amazing. Our letters two and letters three the same, presumably they are. They're three.
Yes.
E.
Yes.
Are you trying to decrypt it yourself?
No. I couldn't begin.
No, Sudoku is quite a complicated enough, thank you.
Well, I know a little German, but not very much.
Yes, I know a certain amount as well.
But you know more than I do, I think.
Yes.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Early in the war, the Kaiser rejected the use of Zeppelins for bombing. But from January 1915, they became raiders of the sky, and the need to fathom a means to destroy them increased. The British installed anti-aircraft guns and searchlights. In response, the Germans flew the Zeppelins higher. At such altitudes, crew needed oxygen. The weather was less predictable, and navigation even trickier. The Zeppelins sent and received a stream of wireless messages to help avoid getting lost, but the UK was already equipped with a substantial chain of listening stations. The airships might as well have been broadcasting directly to the British operators who were waiting for their transmissions.
Lucy Branchick from Event Communications.
Lucy, how long have you been involved with the Road to Blitz Park?
Since the beginning of 2016, I've been working doing the AV components of the exhibition alongside Elbow.
Specifically looking at doing the AV stuff? Because that's really impressive, the three tables together. I really love that.
Yeah, they've turned out really well. We're pleased with the way we've used all the assets and how the research has all come together over the last few months. And we're pleased with how they've all come to fruition within the exhibition space.
So is it your idea where anti-aircraft guns fire and the screen wobbles?
I can't take any credit for that, but I'd like to feel like I was somehow part of the process of getting to that.
Because it's little touches like that. These days you have to have something more than just some boards on the wall, don't you? And the way that you guys have used AV in this is really interesting. I mean, all the way through both sections of the exhibition, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And the aim was to make sure all components of the exhibition sung together and that we were able to use the assets that came from places like the Imperial War Museum to sort of build a story and tell a sort of emotive narrative about this topic.
I've just gone in with the de Grey grandsons, and the thing that they really wanted was that people could read the telegram. And you've done something really clever with that. I've just gone in with them and they just thought it's absolutely fantastic the way you've displayed that now.
Yeah, it's been difficult that, because actually the Zimmermann Telegraph is a complicated story in one sense and has multiple layers of decryption, partly because it was also decrypted from German.
Yeah.
So it took us a little bit of time to work out how to do that, but we wanted something that was quite simple and easy to understand.
I mean, it's simple, but it's really effective, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's this button.
And absolutely.
It's decoded for you.
Absolutely.
Have you enjoyed doing this work?
Yeah, it's been great. It's been good fun learning about code breaking. Spying, isn't it? Everybody likes things like The Imitation Game and anything that involves spies and Bond-like things.
Well, I think you've done an absolutely brilliant job. It looks fantastic. And especially with this half of the exhibition, because it's more in-depth, isn't it? It's more about methodology of code breaking, which could be quite dry, but you've managed to really bring it to life, haven't you?
Yeah, and I think part of that is through some of these great images we've had and some of the brilliant stories we've been able to unpick with the researchers here at Bletchley Park.
The Imitation Game, starring Benedict Cumberbatch as the codebreaker, mathematician and all-round genius Alan Turing, has proved so popular at Bletchley Park's first open-air cinema, we've laid on another showing. It's now on for two nights, Friday the 2nd and Saturday the 3rd of September, on the lawn at the uniquely historic site where a lot of the action is set and key scenes were filmed. It'll be a great night out, so book now before all the tickets go. Here's a reminder why you simply have to see this film, or if, like me, you've seen it a few times, you really need to watch it here at Bletchley Park.
What did you do during the war?
I worked in a radio factory.
What did you really do during the war?
Are you paying attention?
If you speak a word of what I'm about to show you, you will be executed.
It's beautiful. It's the greatest encryption device in history. The Germans use it for all major communications.
Everyone thinks Enigma is unbreakable.
Let me try, and we'll know for sure.
Mr. Turing, do you know how many have died because of Enigma?
No, I don't.
Three. While we've been having this conversation.
That was the environment where men and women from all walks of society, from all abilities, whether it be actors and artists to the more likely candidates of mathematicians and physicists and scientific thinkers, came together to try and crack a code that was basically, or many codes actually, that were the encryption devices of the Nazis, and they were winning the war. The country was starving, the clock was ticking. And to understand the importance of that is also to understand the importance of those men and women and the actual environments of where it happened. So to experience something of that through the extraordinary exhibits and explanations you get, both of the working environment and the tools, the actual, you can see the machine, you can hear the machine working. And it's amazing. You think from that came a reading of a code that basically won us the Second World War. Some estimate by 2 years, and that meant millions of lives were saved. And it was all done in secret, and now we can look at that secret. So how could that not be one of the most important legacies we have in our culture of that era? It's incredibly important that it keeps going, incredibly important that it's open to the public and something that's well-funded and supported and continues, because this is our history.
To pull off this genius routine, one actually has to be a genius.
Why are you building a machine?
The machine will allow us to break every message and win the war.
You could help us, but you won't.
You will never understand the importance of what I am creating here.
I'm just a mathematician.
You've got more secrets than the best of them.
The most glamorous day out you could possibly imagine, the 1940s boutique, is back at Bletchley Park on Saturday the 9th of July. Book now for a full day workshop where you'll learn how to create the iconic 1940s look with victory rolls, perfectly flicked eyeliner, and those red lips that defined a decade. Your tutor for the day is vintage stylist Sarah Dunn of Sarah's Doo Wop Doos. And the vintage pop-up shop, Clarabella's Closet, will be back after a storming debut at The Last Boutique. Details and tickets are on our website. Bletchley Park's Oral History Project has been running for 5 years, gathering more than 300 rich and detailed interviews so far with veterans of the Government Code and Cipher School at Bletchley Park and its outstations all over the world. We're celebrating this rich archive, which is ever-growing as the project continues apace. This month we bring you Cynthia Humble's story. Born into an army family, Cynthia was keen to do her bit for the war effort, so she joined up at the grand old age of 17 and a half. She went on to be posted to Forest Moor, a listening station in Yorkshire, where she made memories which have lasted a lifetime.
Where did you serve?
In Forest Moor, near Harrogate.
Near Harrogate. Yeah. That's well outside the town and...
Yes, it was. We had to go up from... We were boarded in a boarding school that in just outside Harrogate. And then we went up to Forest Moor in a TCV, a troop carrier. And I suppose it took about 20 minutes, half an hour to get there. Mm. So we had to be up early on the shifts when they were early. But they were very odd shifts, sort of a four times a day shift, you right. know.
So four times a day there'd be transport arrives and yes. whoever shift it is yes. just jumps
there were,
on.
There were
and off
four,
you go.
Four actual shifts, watches as we call them. Mm-hmm. And I was on A watch and we started at 1 o'clock on a series of shifts, 1 o'clock until 7 o'clock at night. Then we came back, went to bed, had a meal and went to bed, got up to be on shift again at 7 a.m. the next morning and came off at 1 o'clock. And then we came home to sleep and then we went on at midnight until 7 o'clock the next morning and then came back then to sleep, went on at 7 o'clock that night and came off at midnight. And then the next day, it was a day off. And then it all started again.
I would imagine you're rather grateful for the day off. They're not normal hours.
They're not normal hours, yeah. No. And, of course, having to get out and get into the troop carriers and go, we were up pretty early to do it. And then when we got to the wireless station, we went in, always sat in the same seat, and just went in, and the operator that was from another shift, we just took headphones from her, put them on, and slid into the seat. Very unhygienic. And so it went on, and we had one break in each shift.
So you were doing exactly the same job as the person on the previous
That's
shift?
Right. That's right, yes. And that same frequency.
Same frequency. Yes.
And you had a partner with you, sitting with a set next to you. Mm-hmm. And they did what we call double banking. She was doing exactly the same as I was taking down, so that there was no confusion as to what I was hearing and she was hearing.
So who did the comparisons between the two of you?
Well, what we were writing down in blocks of five on a sheet, when it was full, we just put our hand up and the set room sergeant, who was a male, came and took it. And then it was just whisked away. We didn't know where it went. We'd never heard of Bletchley Park. It was just Station X. We knew it was somewhere, but didn't know where. It was a complete mystery as to where it went and who checked it.
You said the sergeant was male. That makes That's it sound right. as though almost everyone else was female.
Yes, we were. The watch was completely female. Right. And there was a sergeant and a corporal in charge of each set room. A shift consisted of about 80 people. So there were about 20 in each set room. Stayed there until the end of the war. And I was posted then because people were starting to be demobbed. And I was sent down to Bow Manor.
Oh, yes.
Then, and they're still intercepting, but we didn't know what, because the German traffic was finished, sort of rumours that it was Russian, but whether it was or not. And I was there when I didn't know what I was going to do after I came out, because I'd gone in straight from school. And my father, who had been in the Middle East for 5 years, had just come home. And he said, well, why don't you try for a commission? Which I did. And I wasn't 21 then. And I went down to London to the War Office Selection Board, and they decided I was too young for a commission. Come back in 3 months, as though I was going to mature in 3 months. And I went back then and did get through and went to Glenparver Barracks in Leicester for pre-op 2, did my op 2 in Windsor and passed out. And I stayed in until 1950, having met Sam at one of my postings in Chatham. And I came out then. That was it. So I was in 7 years altogether.
Yeah. That was your first job?
Yes, I went straight from school and a secretarial college, which I hated. And I kept on saying to my mother, because Daddy was away, you know, I think I'd rather go into the forces. And she wasn't very keen, but in the end she capitulated, and that's how I got down to, used to go to the Labour Exchange then if you were going to volunteer. That's how I got there, 3 months too early then. And they said I was too young at 17 and 3 months. Come back when you're 17 and a half with parents' permission, which I did. And my papers came exactly at the 17 and a half time.
So did you have any idea what sort of work you might have been doing?
No, my mother said, well, I hope you're not going to waste all the college fees, etc., etc. Make sure that you do a clerical job. And when I, because we were in Stirling in Scotland, yes. So I did my training just outside in Edinburgh in Dalkeith. And they said, did I want to go into ACAC or something like that? And I said, no. My mother said, I've got to do clerical work. And they were very good then and sort of said, well, write to your mother and ask, does it have to be clerical work? Yeah. And so she said, I wrote and she said, yes, that would be all right. So I had a selection of various tests that you had to go through. I always thought that the one that possibly was the one that got me into this lock was the fact that you had to listen to musical notes. And I wasn't any musician or anything like that, but you had to correlate the notes with what you heard.
Yes.
So they decided I would do this. And I wrote to my father, who was in the Middle East, and said, you know, I'm in the ATS now and I've got to do a job, but I'm afraid I can't tell you, Daddy, because it's very important. And he never knew. He lived into his 90s, but when the Enigma business came out, Daddy was retired down in Bournemouth. We were living in Surrey, and when they came to see us, or we went down to see them, it was all about grandchildren and that sort of thing.
Yes.
And it was never in my mind to talk about it.
Mm. So you joined the ATS. How were you trained?
We went to the Isle of Man, Douglas, to the Isle of Man. And we were in boarding houses right on the front of Douglas in the sort of bay. That big curve where all the boarding houses were, the first lot were all occupied by Italian prisoners. Not so much the very important ones, they were in another part of the island, but they were just internees, really. And our houses that we had, downstairs there were the set rooms where we had our training for learning Morse, and upstairs our bedrooms and that. I think there was about 2 bathrooms in each house, so most of us used to go down into Douglas and pay, forget how much it was, 6 months or something, for a towel and a bit of soap and sit on the pavement until we went into the baths and that.
There were quite a number of people being trained at the same time.
That's right, that's right, yes.
And then you all went on to Forest Moor, or
yes, there were Forest Moor and Kiddleston Hall in Derbyshire and Bow Manor, as far as we knew. There had been other places early on before that people went to these various stations, because I know somebody now who started at the beginning of the war, and she was in London for a while and Trowbridge, and then she was at Bow Manor the whole time of the war.
Were you ever told anything apart from this work is for Station X?
We were told we were intercepting German traffic, and it was very hush-hush. We weren't allowed to speak to anyone, not even family or anything like that. And on the papers that we wrote these blocks of five down, it had top secret written in red at the top. And that's all we knew, that it was being sent somewhere and we were doing something of value. But that was it. The worst thing was that you got into a rhythm of five blocks at a time of Morse. And then suddenly, especially towards the end of the war, they got worried, I think. And a few times, instead of sending these blocks of five, they'd start talking to each other, not talking, but sending Morse to companions and that on another frequency or the same frequency. And it was all in German. And it completely threw you, because you were getting not that definite rhythm of the five blocks, but a whole long line of Morse. And all the time you were thinking, what is it they're saying? And I'm sure they got sort of very funny messages at the other end at Station X, because, you know, you missed out a lot, because it just wasn't right somehow not to be taking down these blocks of five. It was very odd.
So you had no idea that this was related to intelligence work?
Well, we presumed it was, because at Queen Ethelberga's was the school that we were at, and we had great grounds there, and apart from the ordinary cooks and orderlies and that sort of thing, and us, there was a branch of the intelligence corps there. And we thought they were snooty, and they looked down on us. We were doing all the work.
Okay, so you went to St. Ethelberga's. Can you remember any of the people who were there with you?
Yes. There was a girl called Sally Taylor who double-banked with me. And I have a friend who was on the same watch as me. She was 6 years older than me and thought I was much too young. She was called up. And I, as a volunteer, used to only get my 13 shillings a week, but she had been called up from being in the post office. She was a telephone operator. And so she got her pay made up. So when the shift went round after the four shifts and having a day off, I could have my 13 shillings and go somewhere, perhaps to the play in Harrogate, or we used to go to a music recital or something. But Edna could do it when the eighth shift came round, but I'd spent all my money then, so I sort of joined the local dramatic society in the, I don't say local as a outside, but in the camp. And we used to have read plays and things, and did the odd, I was in two plays there, while, you know, fritching the time away, because we hadn't got any money.
You've got 13 shillings. Well, what do you have to spend it on? I mean, do you have to buy your own food and cook
No. I mean, I know it was 13 shillings a week, but that included your clothing and your accommodation and your food. There was a naffy there. And if you wanted extra bits and bobs, well, there was a naffy where you could go and buy a cup of tea and whatever. And if you went into the town in Harrogate on your day off, there was always a place like the WVS or the Salvation Army where they had sort of cheap meals that you can get egg and chips for a shilling and something like that. The Queen Ethelberga School was pretty big, and there was a lot of us, or four shifts with about 80 of us in each shift. So we went into the Ethelberga's building, half of them, two watches, and we enjoyed the luxury of being in a brick building. And then you changed over, and the people who'd been in the Nissen huts came into Queen Ethelberga's school, and we went into the Nissen huts. double beds always in the school. They were little, like, cubicles that would take two people with a double bunk in it. Mm. No door, just a curtain across to the corridors. Make sure that nobody got up to any trouble or anything. There was an officer in charge of us if we had any questions to what we should do or how we felt and that. And funnily enough, her name was Subaltern Bairn's father, and her father was the man who used to do the old Bill cartoons, which were quite famous, I think, in the paper. But as far as the actual outstations, it was males who sort of looked after, because it was the Royal Corps of Signals, and we were attached to them.
Your spare time was amateur dramatics?
Going into Harrogate if you had any money. And we used to walk across the fields into Knaresborough, which is quite near Harrogate, and there was a river there, and we'd go rowing there, or get a bus to Fountains Abbey or something like that, you know, just to get away. Ethelberger's was about a 20-minute walk, I suppose, so there used to be the various lorries that went by. We used to hitchhike to get into the town. One hair-raising one was where there was no side. It was a lorry with no sides to it except chains round it, and you sort of just stood, a whole lot of you stood to attention, more or less, hanging on to each other while you were standing up going into Harrogate, because it was mainly downhill and corners to go round. We were young.
yes. So, at work, you've got radio set, headphones, presumably a pad of paper and a pencil.
Yes, a pad, yes.
And that would be it for
that's
the whole
right, yes.
Time.
Pencil, the pencils to write. And you had to keep your left hand on the dial the whole time of the radio set, because the frequencies varied slightly, go faint, and you had to sort of try and get it up again.
So you'd have difficulty on some occasions listening to the Morse. It would just almost disappear.
And sometimes the frequency or the call sign that you were taking down were off the air, and you'd just sit there twiddling with no Morse coming, and that was worse, really, just sort of looking all the time for trying to find, wondering if you'd lost it or whatever. Somebody told me my call sign was O with a bar on the top, L something or other, I can't remember now. But somebody told me that that particular frequency was covering the SS, but I don't know at all. One or two people did take down something that eventually they heard from the sergeant. Came back to them, I suppose, from Bletchley, that this particular girl had taken down quite an important message, and we just sort of took it for granted what we were doing.
Yeah. When you're working with the double banker and your frequency faded away, would that necessarily mean the same for her, or
no,
would she be able
to
cover?
I think, I don't know whether she was on the same aerial as me, you know, because it was just a field of aerials all the way around us.
Yeah.
Which wasn't very nice when it was a thunderstorm or something, because all the time your earphones were sort of crackling, and, you know, and a lot of, we had to learn the Q code, but all I can remember was QRM for interference, and we used to get that a lot. And sometimes there was something that they called jamming, when perhaps they thought that they shouldn't be sending Morse. Somebody might have been intercepting it. I suppose they must have known, and would be jamming the signals. That was a horrible noise.
Can you relate any of the work you did to specific events?
Not really, not until the end of the war. That was a very memorable day, because we'd come off shift that morning at 7, and we knew that something was happening, so none of us went to bed. And we sat outside waiting to hear, and we heard that the war was over. And we were told that half the shift would go on, the other half had the time off. But I was on the shift that had to go on. And we went up there at 7. We'd come off in the morning and it was time to go on at 7 till midnight. And the whole of that 5 hours, we had our earphones on, but nothing coming through. But they brought round soup plates with raisins in them and put them one on each desk. And we'd never seen raisins during the war, you know, rations and things. And when the next shift came on, they came through, and several of them said to us, "You'll need your sunglasses on." And we sort of said, "Why?" Because we were coming off at midnight. And they said, "Oh, wait and see." And when we got outside, the whole of the station was lit up, because normally we'd come in the dark, muted lights and so forth. And just outside where the set rooms were, there was a huge static water tank, very, very big. And the whole watch took hands all round this static water tank. And we, at midnight, we were singing, "There'll Always Be an England." And us, having come, a lot of us having come from Scotland, at the end where it says "There'll Always Be an England," they all piped up in their Scots accents and said, "As long as Scotland's there." That's the thing I shall always remember.
The war ended. You were at Forest Moor for how long?
Well, the war ended in May, didn't it?
Yes.
And I was posted to Bow Manor in the following January. I think they took the girls who'd been conscripted. I think they demobbed a lot of them first. And I was sent down to Bow Manor in the February of 46. And all the shifts exactly the same. And recently I belonged to an association from Leicester and Nottinghamshire of ATS and WRAC, and we had a day at Bow Manor earlier this year and saw the huts where we used to be and in the corridors of Bow Manor itself. It was great big photographs of ATS with their earphones on and their heads down and that. The reason why we went was the association has a standard bearer with its flag, and there was a ceremony to have a new flag blessed. And the mayor of Leicester came, and two of us were pointed out to have our badge on.
Yes.
And he was quite intrigued and said, "How long had you been at Bow Manor?" and all the rest of it. And he invited all the association to go to Bow Manor and have a look round, which was, it was very interesting to, because we were billeted in a place called Garrett's Hay that was over the road from Bow Manor. And we used to go through the wood to get to it, and was told that there was a green lady ghost who used to wander through it. So when we came off at midnight or in the dark, you know, in the mornings, we scurried through to get to our billets at Garrett's Hay.
So whilst you were at Forest Moor, were there just ATS girls?
Yes,
there?
No male operators.
No.
But when I went to Bow Manor, there were male operators, yes, who had come home from India and just billeted there, I think, but although they were still supposed to be intercepting. But we knew that some of them at night used to switch over to jazz, and they're just waiting to be demobbed and get home.
So during the 7 months or so after the end of the war, in Europe anyway, up till you went to Bow Manor, were you doing the same work?
We were still intercepting, but we didn't know who. As I say, there was a rumour going around that it was the Russian traffic, but we didn't know. And one of the girls on our watch was a very ardent communist, and she refused to go on, and she was sent off to another place.
Yeah.
So we obviously thought it was something going on still, but not knowing what.
But it was the same sort of pattern,
yes,
in
these
sendings,
yes,
so
appreciable, yes,
difference.
Yes, because some of the girls before the war ended, and I suppose about the time of the war ending, were asked if they would like to volunteer to go and learn Japanese Morse. And they went to Kettleson Hall in Derbyshire to learn Japanese Morse, and they were going to go out to Ceylon or somewhere. but it all fell through because of the atom bomb and so forth. Yeah. So they were then sent down to Bow Manor to carry on until they were demobbed.
Yes.
And the funny thing was that when Sam and I, my daughter lives in Nottingham, we've only been up here 11 years, and we used to come up and cat sit, and we went to Kettleson Hall to have a look round, and no one had a clue what had been going on there when I spoke to the people in the house there. They hadn't a clue. It's incredible, really.
So you went on to get your commission?
Yes. I was commissioned in the October, and I was 21 in the December. And my father, who had come home from the Middle East, he and my mother and my two brothers were then stationed in Germany, and I wanted to go out there on leave and didn't quite know how it was. And the CO I had, and I was posted to Folkestone to a transit camp for mothers and children who were going to join their husbands in Italy and Austria, and they'd come to us for one night and then go across to the continent from Dover. And my CO got in touch with the War Office and explained about my father being over there, my family. And they said, well, I could go if I took a draft of girls over. So I had to go to Hatfield and pick up about 20 women, all much older than me. And we went up to Hull and went across to Cuxhaven. Yes. And then on a train there up to Bielefeld. Terrified the whole time that I was going to lose them and get into trouble.
Bletchley Park was obviously secret, and your work was equally secret.
Yes.
How long did it take before you felt, oh, it's not quite so secret, I can possibly mention it?
Well, after Folkestone, I was posted to the Royal Engineers Barracks in Chatham. I met Sam, and we got to know each other. Never said anything to him. We were married in 50, never said anything. You forget all about it. You're busy. I just became a housewife in those days. If your husband could provide for you, he did, and you didn't go out to work. And I never sort of said anything to anybody, other than when we had the children. Sometimes I used to hear Morse when we had the radio on, and I'd see if I could still do it. And Belinda, our daughter, used to say, what's that? And I'd say, oh, it's Morse. And when Sam went off to work and hooted his car, when he eventually got a car, I could read Morse in the hooter, and taps dripping, I could read Morse. And still can.
Yes.
I don't even know when Sam knew, do you?
I hadn't a clue till you told me.
As I say, before, I'd never said anything to my father, and I really regret that now. And my mother, when I told her I was in the Royal Signals, she still thought that I was doing clerical work. And I don't think she was very impressed. They just thought I'd been in the Royal Signals.
It was clerical work, dear.
We went down to Bletchley Park about 2 years ago when we were going to get these badges. Yes. It was before they were dishing them out. We went down for a weekend, and on the Saturday, a whole lot of us went to Woburn Abbey for lunch and had a very nice lunch there. Two or three busloads of white-haired, decrepit people, some of them. And then the next day, we went to Bletchley Park. Mm-hmm. And I had already been there once, so I'd had a good look round then. But on this particular day, on the Sunday, the coaches came to the hotel and took us to Bletchley. And that's another thing I shall always remember, because when we went through the gates, all the staff were lining the grass and the pavement, or the verges, as we went by. And they all were all clapping and cheering at us old people. As we went by, and it was a really tear-jerking experience. And we had a nice day there, and then it was time you could go home, but we stayed another night because Sam was driving up here. Yeah. But that was a lovely weekend. And then when I got home, on the doormat amongst the mail was a thing inviting me to go down to get this.
Yes.
I was going to be one of the people and couldn't go because we'd booked to go on holiday. We were going up to Newcastle of all places with the travel agents and going away for a week. And so mine came through the post and I wrote back and thanked them and said, I'd got the citation as well, and said that my father had never known, and that Sam had framed the citation and put it by his photograph. And I got a very nice letter back with a duplicate of the speech that David Miliband had made. So yes. I thought it was very, very nice of them to have done that. One of the girls that I met at this association when I joined, and Lester, the one who'd been at Bow Manor all the time, got to know her. There was only her and me that was Y Signals. The rest were all various jobs, drivers and ACAC cooks, what have you there. And for a joke, I sent her a letter all in Morse and got one back. And whenever we speak to each other now, when I meet her and we say goodbye, I look at her and say, da-da, 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 which means end of message. And she'd repeat.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, veterans and visitors who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk, find us on iTunes and Twitter, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audio Boom, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. And if you like the Bletchley Park podcast, don't be shy, write a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.